So our next speaker is Brant Gardner, and he has worked in the IT software industry and is now doing some scholarship on the on Book of Mormon. And so he is, he will introduce his own. He has no view graphs, but he's got some very nice notes.
See, I love being the black sheep, you know? Can't figure out what to say about me. Don't know really what I do, which is fine. I have no graphics. I have no art. You know, when they're talking earlier about owning who you are, I own the fact that I have no graphic presence whatsoever. I'm lousy at it. And my eyes aren't very good, and I'm going to have to read this darn thing, because otherwise we won't get the content in the time that we actually want to get it. So hang on. Okay. In Shakespeare's Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2, Polonius turns to Hamlet and asks, "What do you read, my lord?" Hamlet responds, "Words, words, words." Sometimes words forcibly impact our consciousness with the power of new ideas. Sometimes words simply fill the air with organized sounds that we understand but quickly forget. Words we speak and words we write are the external means of our communication. But even our internal communication is often couched in words. Even before we say them, even before we write them, we hear them silently dictating what we will say and write. It certainly seems like words and sentences are the stuff of all things great and small that we think and say. Our predisposition to assume that we think in words influences our perception of the process of revelation to God's prophets. God speaks to prophets. Therefore, God communicates in words and sentences. It is an assumption that seems logical, but the evidence is that divine revelation does not require words. Genesis 46 and 2 tells us that God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night. Job suggests that these visions of the night were even more salient to the dreamer than God's whispered words. For God speaketh once, yea, twice, yet man perceiveth it not. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon men, in slumberings upon the bed, then he openeth the ears of men and sealeth their instruction. Job 33:14-16. Dreams are a universal human experience. For most of us, they're wild stories our minds invent. For the ancient world, they could be prophecies. Nevertheless, though all dreamt, not all understood the prophecies delivered in dreams. When Joseph, son of Jacob, was in Egypt, he was visited by a steward and a baker who had symbolic dreams. They approached Joseph, and they said unto him, "We have dreamed a dream, and there is no interpreter of it." And Joseph said unto them, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" Genesis 48. Even had the original dreams contained speech, the critical communication was in the visual experience. Joseph's prophetic explanation converted the visual into the oral. Daniel was a man of visions. In Daniel 7:10, it says, "I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days." Daniel's night visions communicated through the visuals rather than words. In the Book of Mormon, Lehi declared, "I know that I am a visionary man, for had I not seen the things of God in a vision, I should not have known the goodness of God." 1 Nephi 5 and 4. Lehi's dream of the tree of life is a powerful example of a dream communicating through visual symbols. As a visionary man, Lehi apparently understood those visual symbols. Nephi tells of his father relating the dream, not interpreting it. On the other hand, Nephi was a man of words. He was not a visionary man. Nephi's own vision provided the required vision that his father had seen, but it was accompanied by detailed descriptions providing the meaning that his father apparently understood implicitly. The existence of these important prophets, who were, like Lehi, visionary men, demonstrates that contrary to our expectations, divine communication does not require words. Words continue to be the external means of communicating revelation, but the words can describe the visions or provide their explanations. Even when the revelations are represented as having come in words, the revelations are expressed in the words tightly bound to the prophet. They're always communicated externally in the prophet's language. They are always communicated according to the prophet's literary skill, or relative lack of skill. They are always presented in vocabulary appropriate to the prophet's experience and education. While it is certainly possible to postulate a God who endlessly adapts to different linguistic and literary skills in his chosen prophets, it is also possible, it is more probable, that God communicates at a level prior to words, and that the same biological processes that generate our quotidian speech are involved in the external representation of the internal divine communication. I propose that we can use concepts from linguistics to help us understand the nature of divine revelation. I further propose to use Joseph Smith's various revelatory experiences as the test case for the explanatory power of those conceptual frameworks. Cognitive linguistics examines the mechanisms through which we create speech from the nearly infinite possibilities of words, parts of speech, and grammatical structures stored in memory. The evidence suggests that there is a form of pre-speech that we use to generate sentences, some glimpses into a level just before speech comes from examining the kinds of mistakes that children make as they're discerning grammar from hearing the language or surrounding them. Steven Pinker has noted, when children make errors like, all the animals are wake up, don't tickle me, I'm laughable, or mommy, why did he disappear? They could not have been imitating their parents. They must have extracted the mental equivalent of grammatical rules that add suffixes to words and arrange verbs and particles in phrases. When we speak, we create sentences that move from an internal state to an external representation. That representation may be spoken or written, just as children's grammar mistakes have implications of how they learn language. We sometimes make verbal mistakes that have implications for the divisions between meaning and language. We've all had the experience of not saying what we meant. That is only possible if we actually understand what we meant and that somehow that intent rose to an external representation. It misfired, either provided the wrong word or the wrong concept. How many times do we know precisely what we want to say, but the word that we know that describes that meaning is temporarily just out of reach, just on the tip of our tongue? There must be a language of thought that precedes external language. This hypothetical language of thought has been termed mental ease. Pinker explains, mental ease is the language of thought in which our conceptual knowledge is couched. When you put down a book, you forget almost everything about the wording and the typeface of the sentences and where they sat on the page. What you take away is their content or gist. In memory tests, people confidently recognize sentences they never saw if they are paraphrases of sentences they did see. Mental ease is the medium in which content or gist is captured. Although language transcends biology, it is generated in a complex biological machine. Although not a biological process, mental ease is nevertheless a descriptive construct that helps us discuss impulses or meaning that are elevated into language. In its most detailed and structured explanation, it's quite controversial. However, those controversies are less interesting to me than the ability of mental ease to provide an explanatory structure with which can understand divine-to-human communication. Mental ease can help us understand facets of the revelatory experience that produced the translation of the Book of Mormon. Just as we have seen that revelation need not come in words, the evidence of the relationship of the English translation to whatever ancient words were written on the plates suggests that the divinely provided translation came in the form of pre-language meaning rather than specific words. One of the most important examples is the metaphor Mormon uses to describe his people. The Spirit of the Lord hath already ceased to strive with their fathers, and they are without Christ and God in the world, and they are driven about as chaff before the wind. A modern Western audience easily understands this verse because we descend from cultures heavily dependent upon wheat. That grain was so crucial to the formation of sedentary communities, so fundamental to the ability to establish society, that we have inherited metaphors that require an intimate understanding of how the raw grain becomes food. Understanding the metaphor presumes the importance of wheat, knowing what chaff is, and the production method by which chaff is blown in the wind. None of these requirements existed anywhere in the New World. An authentic ancient document written in the New World could not have produced a sentence where chaff was used metaphorically. A culturally appropriate parallel would have referenced maize. This verse cannot be a direct translation of the words of the original plate language. Rather than evidence that the original text couldn't have been authentic, however, we have evidence that the translation communicated meaning rather than specific words. Secular translators understand that when translating metaphors, the meaning is not often conveyed by precisely rendering the words of the original. A translation communicated in mental ease easily explains how the meaning becomes a metaphor appropriate for the target modern audience rather than a potentially confusing replication of an ancient metaphor. It is entirely possible that the original metaphor would be as incomprehensible to us as this one would have been to them. However, even the communication at the level of meaning is fraught with complications. Isaiah identified the most difficult aspect of understanding divine communication. In Isaiah 55 and 8 we find, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord." If God's thoughts are not our thoughts, how is it even possible to understand them? Even at the level of meaning, how can God communicate something humankind has never conceived? How can we find a word when we don't even have that word? I suggest a fruitful model can be adapted from the linguistic process of lexical acculturation. Cecil H. Brown explains, "In 1493, as the head of an armada of 17 ships, Columbus made his second voyage to America. In addition to 1,200 men, on board this vessel were animals and plants never before seen by Americans: horses, pigs, cattle, chickens, sheep, goats, and barley, wheat, chickpeas, melons, radishes, salad greens, sugar canes, and fruit trees in the form of seeds, stones, and cuttings. Both Native Americans and Europeans adjusted in various ways to novel items encountered in the Great Exchange. This adjustment often initially entailed the linguistic problem of deciding what names to give the new things. I propose that we can profitably examine divine communication as an acculturation required by the otherness of God's thoughts and ways. Elements of the ways in which humankind has resolved the need for lexical acculturation with other human languages shed light on prophetic acculturation to the divine." Brown found that Native American languages tended to borrow European words for animals more than for artifacts. He provided no explanation, only the evidence from the data. It's a fascinating question because both the animals and the artifacts were foreign, but the different nature of the lexical acculturation suggests a perceptual difference in the categories of animal and artifact. I suggest a possible model. Artifacts were seen as human constructs and therefore were more amenable to the description in the available languages. Animals, however, were categorically different. They were outside of human creation. As not human entities, they were sufficiently foreign to require a foreign designation, hence the word borrowed from the donor language. I see this distinction providing clarification for certain choices Joseph Smith made while translating. As Joseph received pure meaning, he was required to process that meaning into language. When that meaning could be correlated to available categories, it triggered a lexical acculturation that could adapt current language to the new information. When there was an available familiar construct that could be used to encapsulate the meaning, that meaning could quickly and easily be converted into meaning by adapting the model. In a non-translation scenario, it's the type of process that produces clichés, blocks of language that are stored in memory much as a word might be, but often consisting of strings of words that we produce with no more effort than a single word. In Joseph's translation, this process may explain how New Testament texts were adopted as the translation of meanings written long before New Testament times, and even longer before the model King James version of the text became the external representation of that text. As concepts having a ready model, Joseph translated that similar meaning by using chunks of words readily available, modifying the King James text only when required to clarify slightly different meaning. Joseph adopted the KJV model even when doing so included text that would not have been that would have been impossible in the plate language, such as references to jots and tittles, as in Alma 34:13 and 3 Nephi 1 and 25, that describe innovations in Hebrew writing developed after the Book of Mormon peoples left the New World, or left the Old World. Just as we retrieve cliched phrases as chunks of memory, Joseph included model texts as chunks rather than individual translations. In other words, he didn't even think about them, they just came that way. The second useful concept from Brown's study of lexical acculturation is that of diachronic acculturation. According to Brown, diachronic data indicate that native terms for introduced entities in earlier time states of languages have tended to be replaced by European loans in later time states, especially in Latin American Indian languages. This is in accord with Casagrande's distinction between primary accommodation in which speakers of recipient language have little knowledge of donor languages and no bilingualism, and secondary accommodation in which the recipient language speakers have knowledge of donor language and some bilingualism. Brown found that bilingualism was clearly correlated with the adoption of European loans for items of acculturation. Applying these concepts of acculturation to the prophetic process, we can see changes over time in the affability of the divinely communicated meaning. I suggest that as Joseph became, in a sense, more bilingual in the divine meaning, his understanding and type of acculturation shifted. He became more able to incorporate the divine language as he better learned and understood that language. We see this diachronic acculturation in Joseph Smith's prophetic experience. In contrast to the popular assumption that Scripture is God-breathed and that the words themselves are divine, Joseph interacted with his revealed text in ways that demonstrate a greater respect for meaning than for specific words. For example, Joseph himself made revisions to the text of the Book of Mormon. 2 Nephi 30 and 6 originally read, "They shall be a white and a delightsome people." For the 1840 revision, Joseph changed this to read, "a pure and delightsome people." This is a particularly interesting change because although white and pure have overlapping meanings for many Western cultures, that overlap does not occur in other cultures and languages. If, for example, Mesoamerica were the cultural background of the Book of Mormon, then we would not expect a semantic overlap between white and pure. In Mesoamerican cultures, white was associated with death, not purity. That Joseph would make this particular change suggests that it was due to Joseph's desire to clarify, not retranslate. An even clearer diachronic example comes from Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible. There are two cases where Joseph translated the same text twice. Kent P. Jackson and Peter M. Jasinski provide the background. In light of what we now know about the creation of the new translation, it is interesting to observe that in two places in the Bible, Joseph Smith provided two original translations that vary from each other. The passages, one quite long, Matthew 26, 1 to 71, and the other very short, 2 Peter 3, 4 and 6, were translated twice, most likely because Joseph Smith had forgotten that he had produced the original translations and thus translated the material anew. They note. The duplicate translation of the JST material provides a unique opportunity to examine how Joseph Smith prepared his translation of the Bible. To a certain extent, we have in this situation the necessary components of a controlled test on how this kind of revelation worked. Two independently produced prophetic revisions of the same text. How did divine inspiration result in two translations rendered in different language? More than questions of the differences in the prophets or in the forms of symbols or language, This is a case of diachronic difference from the same person, presumably using the same prophetic method. Jackson and Jasinski's explanation fits well into the concept of mental ease as well as diachronic acculturation. Perhaps it would be reasonable to propose that, as Joseph Smith worked his way through Matthew 26, dictating the text to his scribe Sidney Rigdon in spring of 1831 and again to his scribe John Whitmer the next fall, impressions came to his mind in the form of pure intelligence, enlightened understanding, and sudden strokes of ideas, but not necessarily in the exact words. Responding to those impressions, the prophet himself supplied the words that corrected the problem or emphasized the point or otherwise caused the verse to express the ideas that the Lord wanted it to communicate. This suggestion may explain why the duplicate translations are verbally different. We find a similar process when we compare Joseph's treatment of essentially the same material in the Book of Mormon and his later new translation of the Bible. For example, 3 Nephi 13 and 12 shows no changes from its Matthew 6 and 13 model. However, when Joseph Smith revisited the Sermon on the Mount as he was translating the Bible somewhere between March 1831 and February of 1832, he changed, "Lead us not into temptation," to "Suffer us not to be led into temptation." As with Joseph's dual translation of the Bible, the later translation was rendered differently from the prior version. Joseph's sensitivity to textual meaning may have shifted from the time he translated the Book of Mormon to the time he translated the Bible. That increasing comprehension or bilingualism of the Spirit may explain the differences. They were certainly not differences based in secular translation theory, but owe their existence entirely to the gift and power of God by which Joseph translated. Mental ease provides a foundational understanding for the communication a prophet receives from God. It is a communication of meaning that is rendered according to the prophet's language and culture, or as expressed in Doctrine and Covenants 1:24, "Behold, I am God and have spoken it. These commandments are of me and were given unto my servants in their weakness after the manner of their language that they might come to understanding." When the divine communication more easily finds commonality with our language and understanding, those passages need no subsequent revisions. However, the evidence of the manuscripts of Joseph's revelations demonstrate that his understanding increased over time, leading him to expand the original text to accommodate expanded meaning. Based on the evidence of Joseph as translator and revelator, we may understand that divine communication transcends words. God intends meaning, not sentences. Upon receiving divine pure intelligence, which may represent concepts unavailable in the prophet's native language and understanding, the prophet attempts a conceptual acculturation in the language and concepts available. The passage of time may allow for a continued expansion of understanding, and when the prophet can better express the divine intelligence, the original utterance or writing might be revised. I've suggested that concepts that describe purely human language may assist us in understanding our relationship with the divine language. For some, describing the effects of divine communication in terms that are also used to describe biological processes diminishes the divine and makes revelation too human. I certainly do not suggest that there's anything mortal about communication from God or the Holy Spirit, but when that communication arrives in the human mind, the normal processes of human elaboration of thought into language are engaged. It is the miracle of divine meaning that transcends the biological elaboration of that meaning. Thank you. Did I understand correctly? Joseph changed white and delightsome to pure and delightsome. Yes. Why then does our version of the Book of Mormon read white and delightsome again? I don't think they changed it back. It certainly has said that. If you would ask me, I actually think it works better as white and delightsome. I think if you're actually doing archaeology of the text, white and delightsome is actually a better meaning, but not for the reasons that we typically think and not for the ones I can explain in the time we have. How do you square these ideas with historical accounts of Joseph seeing English words on the seer stone? What choices in word use would be Joseph's and what would be chosen for him? You have to understand that all of the accounts that we have of people of seeing English words came from somebody who never saw the English words. They saw Joseph seeing something in his hat. Joseph said he would see something, and Joseph dictated words. from there, we have absolutely no evidence from Joseph that he ever said, you know, I saw a word. Now, personally, I think perhaps he did, and I think there's a different method. But all of the evidence from the text, the nature of the text itself, tells us that it was something that happened in meaning, and however those words came out, they came because of Joseph and his vocabulary and his learning and his experience. How do you explain the demonstrated fact that the English of the Book of Mormon is not 19th century English, but is an early modern English? That also is going to take a whole long time. However, I'll give you the quick thing. All of the evidence that you see is descriptive evidence. And if you listen to Brother Guy this morning, you know, what you see in science is very different from what you interpret out of science. And so we have a data set, and the data set says these are the words and this is information about them. I wouldn't disagree with the data set. What I disagree with is the interpretation of the data set. It does not appear to be extinct as they are requiring. It doesn't appear to be nearly as old as they're requiring. Recently, Stanford Carmack readjusted the timeline from before the translation of the King James Bible to after the translation, because there's some really good evidence that it had to have occurred after the King James Version of the Bible. I think that what we are seeing in that evidence in the data set is a description of Joseph's dialect, which cannot be retrieved from written literate sources outside of his community. And when you can get to the few texts that we have that he wrote early on, because his education changed and therefore his dialect changes later in life, with those early texts and the revelations, we begin to see some of those same facets and things that were supposed to be archaic and gone. So I think the data set is simply describing Joseph's native language, and we're all talking about the same thing. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.